From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is going after his former national security advisor, John Bolton, on Twitter today, calling Bolton a wacko and a liar. The White House tried and failed to get a judge to stop Bolton from publishing his new book, The Room Where It Happened, which comes out tomorrow, saying the book compromises national security. Here's Bolton responding in an interview with NPR's Steve Inskeep.
I knew there would be trials and tribulations when you displeased Donald Trump, but I have been determined and was vindicated, I think, by the court in laying this story before the American people.
Well, Steve Inskeep joins us now with more on this. Hi, Steve.
Hey there.
And there's a lot in this book. It is a 500-page book. You've read it. Let's just start with that. What stands out to you?
It is a consistent, very, very detailed, lengthy portrait of a completely incompetent president. And I want to underline that John Bolton is a government veteran, somebody with views that many people oppose, but he has a lot of experience in government. And he's clearly disdainful of this president's inability to simply manage a basic process to make decisions in an orderly and rational way. Certainly doesn't come out with decisions that John Bolton necessarily likes. But again and again in this book, he describes a president who's doing policy by, quote, personal whim and impulse, constantly changes his mind, doesn't seem to understand basic things. Bolton writes at one point that he, quote, scoffed at Trump's failure to understand what a trade deficit really was. Yeah. And, you know, this is something that's central to Donald Trump's presidency, is trying to reduce trade deficits with China. Bolton, at another point, gets a little artful almost in saying that the internal structure of the National Security Council, so this is hundreds of people who are there to help the president make vital decisions. Bolton says the internal NSC structure was no more than the quiver of a butterfly's wings in the tsunami of Trump's chaos. The president just doesn't know what he's doing, according to Bolton.
Well, and Bolton was, of course, national security advisor. So he was in the room for conversations the president had with other world leaders. And according to Bolton, Trump and the Chinese president Xi Jinping talked about Trump's reelection bid, and they discussed policies connected with that bid to help President Trump. Here's another clip from your interview with Bolton.
There was a clear linkage between increased Chinese purchases of American agricultural products and Trump's reelection by benefiting farmers in key agricultural states whose electoral votes he needed.
Now, this would have been a bombshell if it had come out during the impeachment hearings or the impeachment trial. What more did Bolton have to say about it?
Bolton said that he was definite about it, although he can't absolutely prove it. Robert Lighthizer, who's the U.S. trade representative, was also in the room for at least one of the discussions that Bolton recounts, and he says it's crazy, it never happened. In our interview, I asked John Bolton, did you take contemporaneous notes and did you have them when you were putting this book together? He rather mysteriously said that all of his notes were destroyed before he left government. It's not clear how he did the note-taking for this book, but it's just so detailed with even the exact times of meetings and so forth that it seems evident he had some kind of records to rely on.
A lot of people in John Bolton's press tour the last couple of days have brought up the fact that he did not testify during the president's impeachment proceedings, either in the House or in the Senate trial. You asked him about that. Here's his response.
My view is that the way the House Democrats set up the impeachment process, that they in effect set themselves up for failure right at the beginning. I considered their strategy to be impeachment malpractice.
So my question, Steve, is if he thinks now that Trump is unfit to be president, why wouldn't he testify in a trial that could have gotten him removed from office?
Well, I don't think that his answer is going to satisfy people who have been critical of him on this point, Jeremy, but his overall argument was that the House approach made no sense, wasn't going to get a conviction, wasn't going to work, and that John Bolton felt he had no obligation to take part in something that was partisan and that was going to fail. Now, in real time, Bolton raised or appeared to raise constitutional issues. He said he was waiting on a court ruling for a different witness to see if he could be compelled to testify or if he would be compelled not to testify. You remember the White House was trying to keep anybody from testifying. Mm-hmm. Bolton said he was waiting for that ruling. In the end, the House impeached without him. There was a court ruling that basically said the whole case was moot by that. And then Bolton, somewhat strangely, then said he was willing to testify before the Senate, although it was pretty clear by then the Senate didn't want any witnesses. In the end, he didn't testify, insists that impeachment only emboldened the president because they tried to go after him and failed to remove him.
Right. I have to say, listening to part of your interview this morning on Morning Edition, one of the things that stuck out to me was John Bolton describing an empty chair in the Oval Office in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic and crisis. Just in the 30 seconds we have, what else in your conversation was a surprise or stood out to you?
Well, I don't know that I'm terribly surprised, but he is quite disdainful of a large number of people that he worked with. This is a very acidic commentary by a guy who's, I don't want to say he's convinced he's the smartest guy in the room, but he is very aware of times that he feels other people are not so smart or are not playing terribly fair. There are other people who left the administration, criticized the president, like Jim Mattis. Bolton would seem to be on the same page with Mattis now, but didn't think very much of him at all at the time.
That is NPR's Steve Inskeep. You can read the full transcript of his interview with John Bolton at npr.org. Steve, thank you.
Glad to do it.
Today marks the fifth week of protests throughout the world in support of Black Lives Matter. Our next guest has created a map showing in real time where the protests are happening, and he's documented more than 3,800 locations so far. Alex Smith is a geographic information system analyst, and he joins us from Tucson, Arizona. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you for having me on today.
Yes, Alex. So first, for people who can't see your map right now, give us an overview of what it looks like and what data you're tracking.
Well, I am tracking every city or town I can find across the world where there have been Black Lives Matter or George Floyd related protests since May 25th. And right now, what I am seeing when I look at the map is an absolute flood of points. The United States, Southern Canada, and Western Europe are just completely, if you zoom out on the world, you can't even make out the country shapes because there are so many points crowding the map.
Yeah, what I see here is that there's a large concentration on the East Coast and southeastern states of the country. But then there are places like North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, that we're also seeing protests in those areas as well. Are there any things that surprise you when you look at this map and through your research?
Well, one of the things that I keep noticing is how many points there are, or how many towns and cities there are in areas that we would, you know, typically consider to be very quote-unquote red areas, you know, or very conservative regions. Many of the news articles that I've encountered when I've been doing my research will have people saying, you know, we've never seen a protest here, or we've never seen a protest where 500 people show up in a town of, you know, 10,000 people.
You mentioned reading news articles. What is your process for adding to the map?
So my process is kind of a combination. I get emailed tips from some folks. I follow some Twitter threads where people have been posting protests happening, and that was actually the inspiration for the map originally, was following a Twitter thread by a journalist who was posting all of these protests happening in small towns, and me realizing, you know, wow, this is so much more than just the big cities.
Yeah, what's a place that sticks out to you that you've heard that's not in the country?
Oh, well, I mean, there was one on Okinawa in Japan, which I think is great. There have been, I mean, every town in the Netherlands has had one. Canada, and, you know, not just southern Canada, but like the capital of Nunavut in northern Canada, way, way, way up in the Arctic, you know, they had one. So I think that's fantastic.
You spend about 6 hours a day on this project.
Yes.
You're constantly updating it. But personally, why are you doing this?
Well, I came back. I actually was teaching English in Japan last year, and I had a one-year sabbatical that I cut short because of the pandemic, and I came back early. And while I have been waiting for my old job, I've had a lot of time to sort of think about these issues. And I personally have been self-isolating because of the pandemic, and I actually haven't been wanting to protest myself, but I realized that with the amount of time I have right now, I wanted to do something to support what was going on. And this felt like a really important moment and something that I really wanted to create a document of the scope of this that I hope might be useful for others in the future too, who can go back and use it to reconstruct, you know, more of what happened, or to use it to create narratives of a lot of the stories that underlie these protests.
That's Alex Smith. He is a GIS analyst in Tucson, Arizona, and he's created a map tracking worldwide protests for Black Lives Matter. And you can check out a link and learn how to contribute to the map at hereandnow.org. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day, and thank you for having me on.
More businesses and public spaces are opening this week in California, and a new rule requires that everyone wear masks while out in public. It's a mandate that has become increasingly politicized. California Surgeon General and author of The Deepest Well, Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, joins us now for more. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Doctor, California is seeing a surge in COVID-19 hospitalizations, and now folks are being asked to wear masks at all times in public places. That's controversial for some. How is California hoping to enforce this, but also address people who see the mandatory mask as an encroachment on their rights?
Yeah, so I think that what we're seeing in terms of the mandatory mask at this point is that the goal of this is really around protecting Californians and protecting their health, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is really the key factor here. And that's the thing that we're trying to, as we are opening back up as a state, as we are considering, you know, how we can get back to economic activity and all of that piece, how do we do this in the safest way possible?
In the past 2 months, California has seen 7 top public health officials resign after facing harassment over recommending the use of masks and other measures. What do you make of this, and how can California battle COVID-19 if it keeps losing public health officials?
I will have to say that being a public health official right now is really hard. Our public health officers all across the state are working incredible hours, and it's a really difficult time. And I think that it's really unfortunate that so many public health officers are facing harassment when they're really showing up to try to protect the health and safety of everyday Californians.
I can imagine this is a conundrum, though, because their jobs are extremely important, and yet you're losing them in the state. What can be done to mitigate, and what are you asking the public when it comes to this? I think there's just the push and pull of people who feel like it's an infringement on their rights, with those who really understand the health implications of not protecting themselves.
Yeah, I think we see a lot of ways in which the response to the COVID pandemic has been unfortunately politicized. And what we recognize is that the public health guidelines, it's not about politics, it's about public health and safety, right? It's about trying to reduce disease and death. And it's also about taking a smart approach to moving forward with balancing being able to open up our state, right, so that we can restore economic activity with the public health and safety. So from that standpoint, I think, you know, one of the things that I think that we can ask Californians is for a recognition that we all have an important role to play. We all can do our part by following public health guidelines, by practicing social distancing, by, wearing a face covering and doing these things that help to keep our friends and our neighbors safe.
Mm-hmm. Of course, California is not just battling COVID-19, but like the rest of the country, grappling with the death of George Floyd and racism. You recently wrote an article entitled "George Floyd's Death is Killing Me," in which you outline the two pandemics we're battling, which includes systemic racism as well as COVID-19. You see a through line and a connection between the protests happening and the disproportionate effect that COVID-19 is having on Black communities. Can you say more about how the two are connected from your view?
Absolutely. I have spent my career as a pediatrician, a scientist, a researcher on a biological process known as the toxic stress response. And what we understand is that when individuals are exposed to repeated threats, and particularly during critical stages of development, that it can actually, these threats activate our biological stress response. And when that biological stress response is activated too frequently, too severely, that it can lead to changes in the way our stress response functions, and actually can lead to changes in our immune system, our brain development, our hormonal system. And this is what scientists are now referring to as the toxic stress response. What we see is that racism is a risk factor for developing the toxic stress response. And that's why I say that it's no coincidence, as we're seeing the COVID-19 pandemic, right, that we are seeing Black and brown folks dying at a higher rate. And as we are seeing right now with the protests against racial injustice, these things are connected. The ways in which Black and brown folks are dying of racism are captured in a powerful and undeniable way in the video of George Floyd's death. But they're also captured in the numbers of disparities that we are seeing in deaths from COVID-19 as a result of the impacts of racism on health.
You know, we've really just recently been talking about this. I'm thinking about the conversations and the deep reporting that's been happening about maternal health outcomes for women of color. But what you just said there, people are dying of racism. What policies can be implemented now that address that racial inequity that is now rendered so clear by COVID-19?
Well, what we need to see are anti-racist policies that go across the board, from our housing policies to, you know, all the way across. It's really going to take us time to really implement. For myself, as California Surgeon General, one of the efforts that I have been proud to lead is an effort called ACEs Aware to help primary care clinicians across the state of California understand how to recognize and address the toxic stress response clinically so that we can look at improving health outcomes for individuals at risk for toxic stress.
So ACEs Aware was just launched in January of 2020. What will be your measures of success? How would you define success? And how many years down the line do you believe we will start to see the outcomes of this type of action?
Well, as a researcher and a scientist, I'm always looking at multiple measures, right? I'm a total data geek, so I'm looking at data all the time. And there are multiple measures of success. I think the one measure of success is how many of our clinicians actually take this ACEs Aware training and become trauma-informed in their clinical practice. That's a really important measure. Another measure is patient experience, patient satisfaction, provider satisfaction, provider experiences. But ultimately, what we're driving to is improved health outcomes.
You know, doctor, as we're talking, I'm also thinking about my children. I worry about the generational trauma of racism and how that will impact them, but also how their own experiences and reactions to global protests might weigh on them. I mean, in our house, we talk about race and racism all the time, especially now. But how would you recommend we strike that balance of allowing them to be children, so to speak, but also keeping in mind that racism is a health issue?
Absolutely. I think as a mother, as a parent of four Black boys, we're having this conversation in my household quite a bit. And one of the things that I do when I'm talking to our kids about it is, we're having these conversations about what we're seeing, about the protests, about racism, about what that means. And then also sharing around helping to make meaning of this moment, helping to make meaning of these protests, right? That hopefully that these protests are in service of getting to a better place, and also helping our kids recognize how they can participate positively in the change. And even if it's just my 4-year-old and my 8-year-old painting signs that say Black Lives Matter, right? that we put in our front yard, right? That's them having an opportunity to be part of the struggle. And I think that it's important for our kids in this moment, not only to make meaning of what's going on, but also recognizing how they can participate affirmatively. Because otherwise it can just feel scary. I think with COVID-19 and with the protests against racial injustice, it can feel really scary for kids. And I think as a parent, one of the things I see that's really important and part of my role is to help them understand, how do we make it through difficult moments, right? Like, how do we show up, and how do we care for ourselves? And then how do we be part of the solution?
That's Dr. Nadine Burke Harris, California Surgeon General. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
The National Association of Realtors said today that sales of existing homes in the U.S. fell almost 10% last month compared with April. Sales were down 26% over last year. That's the largest annual decline since 1982. For Americans in their homes, many have stopped paying their mortgages because of the pandemic, as well as student loans, car payments, and other bills. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. She joins us now. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So give us a sense of the numbers first. How many Americans are skipping loan payments still, and what does that tell you about the health of the economy?
It is unbelievable, actually. 106 million loans, basically, at the end of May. That is triple the number that we saw at the end of April. And this is according to credit reporting firm TransUnion. So just think about that. The number of accounts that are in deferment, forbearance, or some other kind of relief since March 1st, that so many people, over 100 million loans, are needing help. It's a tremendous number, really.
Well, and when you talk about relief, is that the kind of relief that people are going to have to pay back all at once, like next month or the month after? Or is it going to be something that people can have some sort of payment plan that will be manageable?
It depends. For example, if you look at the big categories, right, we say student loans, for example, 79 million loans are in forbearance. Now, most of those are Department of Education loans. And the Department of Ed has basically said there's a moratorium. You don't have to pay these. And those loans will simply be extended on the other end. But there are another number of other loans where I think people are going to be very surprised to find out, like, oh, wait, I owe a balloon payment, of all these months of deferment at once. So here's a very critical piece of information you need to find out, is that any loan or bill that you have in forbearance, which is just some breathing room, you go back to the vendor, to the lender, to the company, and you say, what are the terms of the repayment? You've got to understand this, because you don't want to be hit with a surprise and maybe at a time where you don't have the money to pay for that bill.
Jill, I imagine that many people who may be facing this problem right now, which is that they're seeing the bills stack up, they haven't been able to pay, maybe they've been given some relief, but they don't know how long that's going to last. They may be looking for new loans to take out more money to help pay some of these other bills. Is that getting more difficult?
I think it is. And, you know, one of the clearest examples of that is with home equity. Now, home equity loans are pretty pervasive, usually in normal times, pretty easy to get if you have equity in your home. Well, if you want to try to get a new home equity loan right now, A lot of banks are raising their credit score requirements. They're digging deep. They're not just saying, hey, Jeremy, you've got equity in your house. We'll extend a loan. Home equity loans, new ones, down 43% between March and May. So it is harder to get a loan. That lends credence to the old story, which is it's very easy to get money from a bank when you don't need it. It's a lot harder when you do need it.
Mm. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up tomorrow, we'll keep talking about the avalanche of evictions that some cities fear is on the way as some of these deferment periods expire and people's bills come due. Currently, foreclosure rates on houses are at their lowest level in over a decade. But when the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures expires in August, that could change. Stay tuned for that story tomorrow.
Police are investigating two shootings in Seattle at the organized protest zone in the neighborhood of Capitol Hill over the weekend. A 19-year-old man was killed and a 33-year-old man was critically injured early Saturday. And last night, a 17-year-old boy was shot in a separate incident inside of the protest zone. Let's get the latest from Casey Martin. He's a reporter for KUOW in Seattle. And Casey, protesters have declared the area known as CHOP, a police-free zone. So we understand all three shooting victims were taken to the hospital in private cars by medics in the protest area. Can you tell us what we know today about what happened in these two shootings this weekend?
Yeah, well, police are still looking for information on both of these incidents. No arrests have been made so far. On Saturday, two people were shot inside the CHOP protest area. People carried them to this nearby medic station. Volunteer medics performed CPR until they drove them to the hospital. One person died Saturday and another is still at the hospital. And late last night, there were more gunshots. It's unclear if there was one, maybe two shootings, but definitely a 17-year-old male was taken to the hospital. He was treated for gunshot wounds. It's not exactly clear where the shooting happened. It was very, very close to the CHOP. And on both nights, all the victims were taken by people in CHOP, not police.
Yeah. You know, these shootings have heightened tensions between law enforcement officials and activists who would like to keep this area free of police. Seattle PD released body cam footage showing protesters booing police as they arrived on the scene of the shooting Saturday. What have police said about this so far?
Yeah, police, that when they released that video, they said that they encountered a violent crowd of people. You can hear in that body cam footage, someone's on a PA system, a police officer's on the PA system saying, we are just trying to get to the victim. We are just trying to treat the victim. And from the video, it's not exactly that they're surrounded, but police are saying that they did come up to a violent crowd and were unable to reach the victims. By the time the police had arrived, the victims had already been transported to the hospital.
Yeah, so we understand that the protesters are asking for more help from fire departments and EMTs, but they still don't want police inside of the CHOP. Do they feel like these shootings could threaten the future of this so-called autonomous zone? I mean, what are protesters saying in response to these shootings?
Yeah, protesters feel that everything is kind of riding on keeping the peace. So long as there aren't these skirmishes, so long as there aren't, it's been a very, very peaceful protest for 2 weeks. And it was really shocking and surprising for a lot of people who have been there for what happened over the weekend. People are worried that this will have to inevitably draw police in. But again, this was a protest to say this is a police-free zone. So organizers are trying to centralize more of a formal security network and get in better communication so that there is a clear security in case of emergency. But most protesters certainly don't want to see the police showing up again.
What has Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin said about these shootings?
Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin says she wants to maintain the space as a peaceful protest, says that the protesters have every right to continue a peaceful protest. The city wants to work with organizers and police on some sort of long-term strategy. She released a statement Sunday, but not a lot of specifics other than some near-term strategies, working with trusted messengers and de-escalators in the area, and also maintaining the peaceful protest in the future.
Hmm. That's Casey Martin, reporter for KUOW in Seattle. Casey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, now to a story about field research. Right now, most of it is on hold because of the coronavirus pandemic. Labs are shut down, research ships are sitting in harbors, and scientists, like the most of us, have been stuck at home for months. So what are the effects of these kinds of closures on field research? Xavier Lopez of WHYY's The Pulse reports.
Caitlin Frazier is one of the many scientists around the world whose research has been halted due to the coronavirus pandemic.
I think we got to the boat on a Friday and we're supposed to go out that next Monday. And in between the Friday and Monday, the trip got canceled.
She's a project scientist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego, studying marine mammal acoustics.
We build underwater acoustic recording devices and they sit on the seafloor and record for about a year at a time. And they collect all sorts of sounds that marine mammals make underwater.
From these recordings of blue whales and other mammals, Frazier and her team try to understand how climate change is impacting marine life.
We have, for example, in the Gulf of Mexico, a 10-year time series that we've been maintaining since the Deepwater Horizon spill. And this spring, we were supposed to start collecting the next 10 years of data. And, you know, there goes that time series for now, which isn't the end of the world, but the longer it goes on, the less useful those data become.
Frazier's team was supposed to retrieve a bunch of these devices from the ocean floor to install new batteries in them and collect last year's data from their hard drives. But some of those trips have been canceled. The team is still trying to get out there and service instruments that are within reach, but a handful of them aren't and are just waiting at the bottom of the ocean. The effects of the coronavirus have already impacted so many other parts of our society. People are dying, unemployment is at an all-time high, the economy is tanking. But the thing about science is that it trickles down. This kind of data collection might not make or break us, but it's part of many field experiments that add to the tapestry that is our understanding of the natural world. And in order to understand that, we need good, solid data.
We have to have that data. We have to have the data all the time.
Alexandra Whitsey is a science journalist for magazines including Nature and Science News.
The planet's changes are happening faster and faster. And unless we have all these instruments around the world working all the time taking data, we cannot track how quickly things are changing.
Whitsey says that this data collection is extremely important for environmentalists who are trying to make an impact on issues like climate change.
And that's the type of data that we have to be able to bring to the policymakers to say, look, changes in the Arctic are happening faster than ever. We've got wildfires in the west. We've got temperature soaring in the south, southeast. This is new data. This is fresh data. We've got to keep that going year after year in order to be able to have the full story that we can then bring to the table and say, okay, what are we going to do about this as a society?
Many of the repercussions of this lack of data gathering are still unknown, in part because everything is changing so rapidly. As places slowly reopen, scientists may soon have the opportunity to continue their work. But one thing that the researchers I spoke with all agreed on is that these disruptions are really going to impact early career scientists the most.
I was in India in January. I was on a Fulbright student scholarship, and I was supposed to be there until, you know, the following January 2021, at least.
That's Sarika Khanwilkar. She's a third-year PhD candidate at Columbia University studying forest degradation in India. This summer, Sarika had planned to start a project where she would place sound recorders in the forest to measure out biodiversity. But as the outbreak picked up speed, she realized she couldn't stay there anymore. On top of that, the U.S. State Department ended all Fulbright funding beginning in June, which meant that even if she had stayed in India, she wouldn't have been able to conduct her research.
One of the, you know, strong points of being a Fulbright researcher is your ability to have that support when getting permits to work in certain places, which can be one of the largest hurdles to doing field research in a foreign country. And once that support was going to be over, there really was no reason for me to stay in India.
Ian Billick is the executive director of the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab in Colorado, where many types of field research take place. He's concerned about what this type of large-scale fieldwork disruption will mean for the future of our world. He says that the amount of money that the United States spends on field research is essentially nothing, which is a big mistake, since fieldwork is very important to our understanding of biology, and specifically the type of biology affecting us all right now.
We need to invest in long-term research well beyond what we're currently investing in. We need to be able to identify emerging disease. We need to understand the interface between wildlife and disease. The coronavirus that everybody's experiencing in this pandemic, it emerged at the interface between humans and wildlife, you know, bats and pangolins. So field stations are one of the best places to understand how that interface is working.
Billick says that given all of the scientific advancements that have been made in the past few years, we could have been better prepared to respond to the coronavirus, and that we shouldn't be taken off guard by any new organisms, whether they're viruses, bacteria, or other pathogens sweeping through the environment. For Here and Now, Xavier Lopez.
After what feels like the longest spring in the history of time, it is now officially summer. It started on Saturday, and that has Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst thinking about grilling. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy.
So yes, this is the time
I am
of
very
year.
Much. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say I'm grilling like crazy. Being outdoors has never felt so good.
Well, and by the way, you know, this is the hard part about this situation is that unlike usually when you get to come in and bring me all kinds of delicious food that I can taste while you're talking about it, we are at a distance right now. So there's a little bit of a delay. But, you know, one of the things that I know you want to talk about grilling is fish. And a lot of people find that to be very intimidating. I often will just say, "Hey, Lexi," and I'm using a code name for the Amazon smart speaker so I don't set them off all over the country. I say, "Hey, Lexi, how long am I supposed to grill a swordfish for?" But what are your tips? How can people do that?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that grilling fish might be the simplest of all. The very first thing I'd want to say is check out the Guide to Sustainable Fish Choices that's put out by the Monterey Bay Aquarium. We have the link on the web. They go through it state by state. You want to preheat your grill at least 10 minutes before cooking, medium hot, around 400, 425 degrees. Now, this is key no matter what you're grilling. You want to use a heavy-duty barbecue brush or even a vegetable brush to totally clean the grill off of any debris from the last time you grilled, because if your barbecue grills are clean of food, they're going to have much less chance of sticking. And I always lightly grill lightly oil the grill rack just to keep it from sticking. I also tend to really like to keep the skin on the fish because it protects the fish, keeps it moister. And in the case of salmon and other fish, that crispy skin is a delicious treat.
Do you flip it or you just leave it on one side?
I do flip it, and here's what I do. I sometimes put whole scallions or rosemary branches down on the hot fire. I put the fish flesh side down first, let it cook. What the scallions do is create a kind of aromatic bed for the fish. Then I very gently flip it, trying to keep the scallions there, and let the skin crisp up on the other side. So I have a very wonderful recipe that's quite generic, actually. It's a grilled fish. You can use this for salmon, swordfish, any type of firm white fish. I add a little olive oil, dill, and chives, and lemon juices, and grill it right on the scallions, flesh side down first, flip it over gently. And here's another tip. I always take my lemon, cut it into wedges, and throw it on the grill. And what happens is the lemon gets smoky, it gets these beautiful grill marks, and you squeeze that on your cooked fish, and it adds this lemony smokiness just super quick. Another recipe is for fish kebabs. This is like so much fun, taking all different types of fish and vegetables and alternating them on a kebab, a basil leaf next to a piece of tuna, next to a pepper, next to a cherry tomato, next to a shrimp, and on. There's a beautiful photo. And that's a really fun recipe because if you live in the Midwest and only have whole trout or different types of freshwater fish, you can also grill them whole very simply by putting lemon and herbs in the cavity and grilling it about 10 minutes on each side. So I take you through a bunch of those. And then many people just want a grilled chicken. So I made a recipe with a cilantro garlic mint marinade that is my current passion. You throw a whole lot of fresh cilantro and mint and garlic into a blender. You put it all over a cut up chicken and you grill this chicken for about 10 minutes per side. And it's wow. It's it's very powerful flavors.
Well, and we've got all these up at hereandnow.org. Now, a lot of people, especially with the 4th of July coming up, Kathy, may want to hear about burgers. And you've got a very interesting burger to talk about to put on the grill.
I do. Something a little bit different. I take ground lamb, which is really a delicious meat when it's ground, and I mix it with some toasted pine nuts or walnuts, some chopped fresh mint, and feta cheese, which keeps it really moist. And this lamb feta burger is so good. You could also use ground turkey or chicken if you don't want to eat red meat and just add a little bit of olive oil to keep it moister. Just a nice, you know, change from the regular burger. And of course, you know, we have on the website those vegetarian burgers that we did last year.
Right. And that was a very popular segment where we went through all of the not meat burgers and got a lot of comments about that. But I just want to say, speaking of vegetables, Kathy, I have been doing this thing where I take a corn on the cob with the husk on it, soak it in water, and then just pop it on the grill. And it's it cooks perfectly.
It does. And then you can put like herb butters on it. You can throw some chili powder on it. The grill is really a good friend to virtually any food.
Especially when you have Kathy Gunst's recipes, and we will put them again at hereandnow.org. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, thank you as always.
Thanks, Jeremy. Stay well.
You too. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.